New York area listeners, just a reminder, Andrew Talks to Chefs is doing our first live show at the Brooklyn Podcast Festival. Join us at the Bell House in the Gowanus neighborhood of Brooklyn on Saturday, January 12th at 2:30 p.m. with special guests Tom Colicchio, Greg Backstrom, Alex Raj, and Alan Harding, plus a live performance of our theme music and other songs by the Brooklyn-based band Fathers. Tickets are $15, but with the promo code Andrew, they are yours for just $10. Visit ATTC, that's short for Andrew Talks to Chefs, ATTCBKPodFest.eventbrite.com, or if that's too long to remember, visit the event page on my blog, tokeland.com/appearances. Hope to see you there.
The Heritage End of Year Fund Drive is officially on. Become a member today at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
You know, there's not that much difference between, like we were saying, you know, these restaurants are partly shows in themselves. And so, you know, your timing is very important. And so it wasn't that much of a stretch to coordinate. Instead of coordinated with the diners finishing their course, we coordinated with the action on the stage.
That is pastry chef Bill Yassis of the Four Seasons Restaurant in New York City and the chef of the Broadway Production Network, our guest today on Andrew Talks to Chefs. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, and today's guest is sort of a legend in the culinary world. His name is Bill Yassis. Many of you might have heard of Bill in the last several years because he was the pastry chef of the White House. He came in during the George W. Bush administration and then served the Obamas. President Obama famously referred to him as the crust master for his flaky pie crust. He actually founded a company called Perfect Pie after he was there. He's been involved with two Broadway shows. He did the food service for the play Sweeney Todd. We explained during the interview for those of you who don't know the play, but pies play a prominent role in that show. And we get into how Bill got involved in that. And then that rolled over into his involvement in the current production of Network with Bryan Cranston from Breaking Bad, which has earned rave reviews. Bill is also the pastry chef at the new Four Seasons restaurant in New York City. As some of you may know, and I'm only going to touch on this briefly, the restaurant has been the source of some controversy lately. I'm not going to hash that out here. Bill and I did an interview about his entire career, including about his current gig. And I want to give Bill the floor. Bill has his own relationships there, and I'll let him speak to those. And I'm not going to let the rest of it intrude on an interview with somebody who I consider to be a legend. So I'm just going to let the interview speak for itself. But I will say that earlier in his career, he was the original pastry chef at Boulay Restaurant, David Boulay's four-star restaurant in New York City. He spent time at Tavern on the Green. Bill's seen a lot, and I think as much as anybody I've ever met in this profession, he has found ways to constantly refresh what he does and keep it really interesting. He's a ball of energy. He's also an incredibly intelligent, cultured, interesting person to speak to. And I think you're going to really enjoy this interview. So with all that, I'm going to turn it over to our interview. We met at the restaurant on a rainy Sunday afternoon a few weeks back in New York City, and I think that's all I need to say about it. Here you go. My interview with pastry chef Bill Yassis. Well, we don't need to get into it. This is a third time's the charm situation.
Yes, it is.
But
we hope. We haven't finished it yet.
We haven't completed the interview, but at least we've gotten to this stage.
Right.
First of all, this was so interesting to me. When I arrived, you said that when you do interviews, you like to sit side by side,
yeah,
and not across.
Yeah. I like that in restaurants, too, when I'm seated with someone, I like to be... I'm one of those dining hogs that likes to take up two tables so I mm-hmm. can sit on a banquette side yes. by side with the person I'm with. And what I like about that is that across the table could become, or at least sort of sets up a dynamic of confrontation. So I think it's less confrontational when you sit side by side. Mm-hmm. And I learned this when I was in a marriage counseling session with my husband.
Yeah.
And our therapist said, have you ever noticed that conversations go better when you're in the car? And her theory was that you're sitting side by side. You're not face to face, eye to eye. You're both sort of thinking about other things. You're looking at the world. You're thinking about the world with yes. another person as yes. opposed to across from them when you're
interesting.
Against the other person.
Are most people as receptive to it as I was in interviews?
Well, you can't always do it. No, I mean, if you're in a sound studio, they're not going to...
Right, they're not going to rewire that. Right, they're not
right,
going to reconfigure the room.
Most people don't mind.
Okay. Are we the only people in this building today?
No. I have a small team with me.
Okay. But we are here on a Sunday. I should say it's a dreary... I don't know why. I find it has to be where I was in my life at the time when I worked in Midtown. But I find rainy Sundays in Midtown Manhattan... I think there's nothing sadder.
Magical.
You find it magical.
I find it so magical.
I find it sad. And I think it's because when I had a job in Midtown, when in my 20s, I was a sad, lonely dude. But why do you find it magical?
Because it's all mine. you contend with the New York concentration of people all week
yeah.
long, and then you come here on a Sunday.
Yes.
And it's rainy, and it's romantic, and yeah. it's like the Woody Allen movie Manhattan.
Yes.
That's the real New York.
Like, yeah.
It belongs to me.
It's funny. There's a shop across the street. I've never been in it. Mm-hmm. Duke.
No, it
there's,
well.
There's like one customer in there.
Well,
I was looking at it this morning going, why are they open?
I don't take this the wrong way, but they're Korean.
Okay.
And they're open 24/7.
Oh, they are.
And,
okay, so they're always open.
Saturday, you notice everything else here is closed.
Yeah.
Because there's nobody
Starbucks
here.
Even is closed
Starbucks
next door.
Starbucks is closed. That's weird. And no, but yeah. Duke, if they have a customer, they're open.
Okay. So, Bill, this is, I think about your career. Mm-hmm. And, there's that famous line, there's no second acts in American lives.
Mm-hmm.
What act are you on?
Oh,
you've kept so engaged.
Old, that's all.
No, but you've kept... My impression is you've managed to keep your craft and your career... You've reinvented what you do... Not what you do, where you do it, and to what purpose you do it, and for whom you're doing it. Mm. In the last decade and a half, maybe you've really managed to keep refreshing. Is that accurate?
I believe I have. I've made a concentrated effort. Not to slow down. I'm not trying to prove anything. I mean, early in my career, I had great successes, and I just feel like, as a personal sort of philosophy,
yeah.
I just want to do all I can, and I want to make the most carpe diem.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought that, and hopefully practiced it.
Right.
And I'm having a blast.
Okay. Can we go in Benjamin Button sequence? Can we go backwards?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. Yeah.
So let's talk about the things you are engaged in right now. First of all, we're sitting here at the new home of the Four Seasons.
Yeah.
What drew you to this project, and what's it been like taking it on?
Well, I've been friends with Julian Nicolini and Lisa Nicolini for years. And in fact, I went to school with Lisa many decades ago.
Mm.
And we'd just always been chummy, and I was around the restaurant from time to time, like doing a class or, just seeing them. And I think all New Yorkers have kind of a vested interest, let's say, cultural interest in the Four Seasons restaurant. It created the modern restaurant.
Yeah.
I mean, it was and still has this sort of like a artwork sensibility. I mean, Phyllis Lambert, who's still alive, by the way, and was here.
Oh, yeah.
Was, her her father, Edgar Bronfman, or was it Samuel? I'm not sure of the whole history. But anyway, he said, oh, I want to open a restaurant, and we're going to, you know, do it with the restaurant associates or whatever. And she said, well, if I'm involved, I'm taking over. And this is very Phyllis Lambert thing to say. She did, and she was living in Paris, and she said, well, there's a great architect here, Mies van der Rohe. That's who's going to do it. And Mies van der Rohe, I think, did not have a New York architectural license, so he had to partner with Philip Johnson. And then all kinds of people got involved. Ada Louise Huxtable, who was the New York Times design editor at the time, was also she did the tableware design. Eero Saarinen did furniture. I mean, these are the, you know, giants of mid-century modern design, although I didn't even know if they called it that then.
Right.
And
On the culinary side, James Beard consulted. Mimi Sheridan was part of the team.
I mean, and when you look back on it, you're like, they were just like, oh, yeah, we're opening a restaurant.
Right.
But they were creating an entire new culture, and all restaurants, I think, since then had, whether they are directly in that lineage or not, restaurant as event, as...
Yeah, as it was kind of like the...
cultural icon.
It was sort of
born.
Like when Hollywood, when the blockbuster came to Hollywood.
Yeah,
that was a
true.
New type of movie.
It's a blockbuster, yes.
Right? This was a blockbuster restaurant.
We're not just feeding you.
Right.
We're recreating the world.
Yes, or as my friend David Waltuck would say, dinner and a show.
Yes, right. Supper theater. Supper
right,
club.
Right. Without an actual show. The dinner was the event was the show.
That's right.
But what? So beyond your personal connection, beyond this historical reverence, what made it compelling? Was it something that immediately you thought, yeah, this sounds like right up my alley?
No, I mean, because, I mean, I was, like, told myself when I left the White House that I was never going back into restaurants. So I did other things. I did, like, you know, little speaking tours and stuff like that, and I missed it. So it's the only thing I've ever done in my adult life, and I was really not happy not in the kitchen. So, and then talking with Alex and Julian, and they're generous, kind, just wonderful people. And, you know, and they obviously were fully committed to recreating Four Seasons 2.0.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very exciting project.
Mm-hmm. Did the fact that the restaurant had moved to a new home, I have to imagine that changed the nature of the assignment.
Sure.
Maybe made it a little less daunting if you would have been daunted by doing it in the original. You're nodding affirmatively.
Yes.
maybe gave you a little more license. Maybe allowed you to be a little more free in how you came at
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. If they were still in the other place and said, oh, can you be our pastry chef, I probably would have declined.
Oh, really?
But yeah, this is so exciting. The architect is Issei Weinfeld, a Brazilian architect who had not really done I don't think he had done other restaurants before this one. And he has a very kind of Japanese sensibility. The room we're in is a very serene. In the sort of legacy or the heritage of Mies van der Rohe, there's a lot of right angles, but it's so warm and cozy, and every surface just makes you want to touch it. The wood, the stone floors, the leather banquettes, the everything, just is warm and cozy and rich in a tactile sense. And so when I saw those plans too, that made it equally exciting. Much of it is, and he's a advocate of sustainability and rainforest, and so there's a lot of elements, even though it's a very modern design, of a kind of Brazilian landscape. The wood is teak. There's these raindrop crystals in the windows, and the whole place is just shimmering and beautiful.
Yeah. So what was it like designing the dessert program here?
Well,
how'd you go about that?
It was very interesting because they have a huge library of the old menus, which were, the actual menus from 1958 and on. And the shocking thing was, like, how advanced they were at the time. I mean, there's things on those menus that you some places would have a difficult time introducing today. Sea urchin and cloudberries and all the wild mushrooms were already on that menu in 58, 59. You know, apparently, Beard was involved. And it was just a beautiful menu. So that was exciting in itself. And, there was not a lot of go-around with the owners about the direction of the menu. They merely said, I mean, one of the few restrictions I had was, you know, it's an American restaurant, so we try to use English on the menu. My background is French, so sometimes that I run into a log jam there where I don't know what the English word
is. Ironically,
it sounds very pretentious,
yeah.
But,
no.
You know, I mean...
That's how you're wired. Yeah.
Yeah. Marron glacé sounds so much better than candy chestnuts. But anyway, it was exciting, and my own sensibility kind of matches theirs in that I like a very recognizable dessert. I like to know what it is as much, and I love molecular gastronomy and the whole modernist sort of style, and I love playing with it as a special. But in this restaurant, I mean, it really seems like there should be a solid American dessert heritage on the menu, and so that's what we have done.
Mm-hmm.
We did resurrect an item from one of the early days. So one of the pastry chefs here was Albert Kuman, who sadly passed away last year, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
He created what was called the Barroom Chocolate Cake, which is really a chocolate Napoleon. So it's chocolate puff pastry with at that time I think it was buttercream, but we've replaced that with a sort of a fluffy ganache. And so that's an homage to the original dessert menu. But it all is kind of an homage to the original, because we're staying very much in the American sort of lexicon of desserts. There's a crostata, there's a baba. That's another one, like what's English for baba or savarin?
Yeah, right.
But we do it in a, I suppose, what would may look like a smaller portion to them in the 50s and 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have a cart anymore. They had a dessert cart
mm-hmm.
with large cakes and all that. So I think we're modern. We're fully in the zeitgeist of dessert making these days. They're smaller, they're lighter, the ingredients are top quality.
Mm-hmm. The chef here is a younger gentleman. What's the dynamic like between the two of you?
It's really
fun. Is there an interesting give and take there?
Diego Garcia.
Yeah.
He's wonderful.
He was at Le Bernardin previously.
Correct. Sous chef at Le Bernardin. Then he had his own restaurant called Gloria, which was also fish-centered. He's an awesome person. He's a friend. He's a great manager. He's a brilliant chef. He'll kill me for saying this, but he's Cher's nephew.
I did not know that. Okay.
So... what gay man in New York City is not going to want to work with Cher's
right.
nephew?
Okay.
He doesn't talk about it. But.
So you're not only doing that. I don't know the exact nature of this, but you were involved in, if my count is correct, unless there's one I'm unaware of, but the second Broadway production that you've been connected to, Sweeney mm-hmm. Todd
yes.
previously, mm-hmm. and now the about-to-debut network
mm-hmm.
starring
That's
Bryan
true.
Cranston.
Yes.
What exactly are you doing with this show?
When I moved back to New York, I started what I call a pie company, Perfect Pie. And about that same time, there were the producers of a London version of Sweeney Todd in New York looking for a venue. And so they decided they wanted to actually serve pies. It was an immersive experience. They wanted to build a pie shop and serve pies, and then the show would be performed around the audience. And this was because they originally did this show in the oldest pie shop in London, Harrington's. and which is a really cute, only like 25-seat little restaurant in Tooting, South London. And so they did this. They jammed this show, this little show, into this tiny restaurant, and they were standing on the tables, so there was just no room for a stage.
Right.
Anyway.
Can I interrupt for 1 second? For people who aren't, like I was a former theater kid, you know the play. Sweeney Todd, if I'm not mistaken, the subtitle is The Demon Barber of Fleet Street?
That is correct.
And what is it about?
So it
how
is
do the
about
pies figure into this story?
A vengeful barber who was wronged in his life, terribly wronged by a corrupt justice system in the 19th century. And he takes his revenge by when he gives haircuts, this barber, on Fleet Street. He ends the haircut by slitting his customers' throats. And he's happy with that system. He's quite content to keep going. But his neighbor downstairs, Mrs. Lovett, has a pie shop. And she decides in a beautiful scene that this would be an inexpensive way to provide meat for her meat pies. And so he slides them down a chute to her, and she butchers them and cooks humans into meat pies.
Okay. So that's how the pies figure in.
Charming tale yes. of cannibalism.
Yes. Yes. So, Soylent Green is people.
That's right. It is very much Soylent Green. And so, but it's believe it or not, it's a comedy. So Stephen Sondheim is the composer, and it's quite witty. And so this incredible production was done in a pie shop, a real pie shop, in London. And because the producer, Rachel Edwards, was walking down her street in Tooting one day, and there was a barbershop on one side of the street and the pie shop on the other. And so that kind of occurred to her, like, this, the universe is talking to me. Anyway, make a long story short or longer, they decided to come here, and they saw, oh, Bill Yostis, oh, he's making pies. So let's have him make these. And they were like, do you want to do pies for our off-Broadway show? I'm like, sure, what is it? And they're like, Sweeney Todd. I was like, no. But I'm a sucker for an English accent. So
okay.
So we did it, and it was a huge success, at least in our own minds. And
now, how did that work? What did you...
So
you
were I had a little commissary in Long Island City. We made them there. We brought them into the Barrow Street Theater.
Yeah.
And they did recreate a pie shop, exactly like Harrington's. And the people came in and they had their pie. They sat down at a communal tables and had their pie and mash, mashed potatoes. And then they slowly sort of some other people came in and sat down who were dressed in kind of 19th century costumes. So, you know, something's up. But they would sit and they would talk with the customers and then at one point burst into song. And there was a small orchestra and all that. So the whole pie thing in England is fascinating. I didn't know about it. Can I
please
go off on
that?
Yeah,
of course.
Tangent?
That's what we're here for.
So apparently these pies were meant to be for a working class, very, very quick, rapid, cheap, and they still are. They're £2.75 now to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So something people could grab in a hurry and filling and mashed potatoes and what they call liquor, which is a kind of a green gravy. So you would get that and your pint, and that would be your lunch or dinner. And to this day, they have a very devoted clientele that show up there every day. But it came from the fact that there were eels in the Thames, a lot of eels. And people were catching eels, and they were making pies out of eels. So they were meat pies, but the meat was eel meat.
Huh.
And so that's how it really started. And so sort of logos on the wall are ships, and there's all kinds of nautical themes in Harrington's because they were catching. And so that's still like the traditional English meat pie is often an eel pie. So you have these drawers that they pull out squirming eels, slam a nail through their head, skin them.
Oh, that's what they do. They don't salt them to death.
Yes.
That's the other way, isn't it? Can't you salt eels to death?
Yeah. It's quite gruesome.
Yeah. Can I just ask, though, when they did the classic, you said that they would call them meat pies, but they had eel. Were they cooked in such a way to try to disguise their
eelness? Oh, not at all.
Eelness?
No, they love the eel. The English love the eel pie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so we had a sign on our counter, sorry, we're out of eels, because we didn't think we were really going to be able to sell. So mine turned into kind of a chicken pot pie.
Okay.
A little more anodyne version.
Got it. So you were doing daily production, and then they would be transported from Long Island City to the theater?
Brought them in, and I served them, too.
Did you? And you enjoyed that part of it?
Loved it.
You loved it.
You get to meet the customer, and you're sort of, you know, you're wink and a nod about what the ingredients are.
Of course,
that was a lot of fun.
That's great. Okay, so network is what?
Okay, so
how does that connection make sense?
Yes,
right, that's very clear. The there's pies are a central part of Sweeney Todd. Network, and again, I'm going to say for people who don't know or aren't as old as
we are,
Network was a brilliant movie. I want to say it came out in '76.
That's right.
It was written by Paddy Chayefsky, and it was about. The famous line that even people who may not know where it comes from is, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. And it's about a fading newscaster who turns into sort of this figure that predicted Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity and all of these sort of cult of personality television figures, and he would come on the air and do these nightly monologue / rants, and that's in short what the original movie was about. It's now turned into a play, which I guess debuted in London and did extremely well. Bryan Cranston of Breaking Bad is the star, and it's coming to New York imminently. So how does what you do figure into that?
So that's a little more of a tenuous connection. So we. So, you know, Sweeney sort of got me in touch with a lot of theater producers and people in that field. So when this is the National Theatre of London that put it on in London, and when they came to New York, my name popped up, and there again, I was like, "What's the connection?"
Right.
Because there's not really a lot of food in network, but you described it very accurately. This sort of a latter-day prophet who turns into this ranting, raving madman, and the movie really did predict our era. It's
stunning.
The creation of Fox News, and
at a time when there were three television networks.
Yeah,
I mean it's stunning.
Yeah, so he has this fading newscaster. His ratings are going down, and he has basically a nervous breakdown on stage. On camera, and that boosts his ratings, and then these cynical television executives say, well, let's use it, and they keep putting him out there, and he goes more and more insane, and the ratings keep going up.
Yeah,
that's the gist. So the connection is, it has more to do with the director than the story itself. So the director is Ivo van Hove and Jan Versweveld. So they are a very innovative directing team. Ivo did The Crucible and on Broadway, and they have amazing sets. In this particular case, Network, they have huge screens, which so even though you're in a live theater, some of what you're seeing is on a big screen. And the point of this is that we have merged the kind of our own reality. We've kind of given up our own stake in living, and we thrive off of a screen.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whether it's a computer screen, in those days it was television screen. But one of the themes of the movie is that we've given up our own autonomy, and we do what the screen tells us.
And reality, and our own reality.
We don't have a reality. We just exist through this screen. Is that what they're wearing? Is that what they're saying? Is that how they raise their children? Is that how they eat? That's what I will do.
But have you had moments like this in life? Not at tennis matches, but my son loves basketball. So once in a while we go to a basketball game and they have their screens. right? So very often around over the center of the of the court, and I'll catch myself watching the screen.
That's right.
And I've done the same thing at, at concerts.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
if it's a huge venue like Madison Square Garden, there will be the obviously the band on stage, but then there will also be sort of a Diamond Vision screen or the equivalent of that. And I'll catch myself watching the screen. I'm like,
it's twisted.
What am I doing?
It's twisted.
Why
yeah.
am I watching the screen?
Yeah.
I paid to be here.
Right.
Why is there a screen?
Live your life. And like so many people yeah. with the phone thing and the photographs.
Yeah.
Like, I'm, you know. Everything doesn't have to be photographed. You don't have to live through that screen. Live
well, that's the
life.
Other brilliant, you know, you want to talk about prescient lines. There's a line in Truth or Dare, the Madonna film.
Right.
And in the movie, do you remember that she's dating Warren Beatty at that time?
Right.
And somebody says, do you mind if we film this? Or do you mind? I haven't seen it in a long time. Do you mind if we take a picture? And he said, does she mind? It doesn't really happen if it doesn't happen on camera.
That's right.
Right?
It does really
And that
happen.
Is one of the great... It's like, to me, that's up there with Andy Warhol's 15 Minutes
15
of Fame.
Minutes
yeah,
of fame.
I mean, it was so predictive.
You know, and I think we sort of dance around this subject. And there was an article in the Times a couple of weeks ago about how Silicon Valley executives and media executives really limit their kids' screen time because it's like cigarettes.
Yes.
You know, they know how damaging it is. They know how dangerous this giving up autonomy is. And so that gets to how do I get involved?
Yes.
Because in the London production and in this production, there's a restaurant on stage. And there are some scenes in the restaurant, but not actually that many. But the idea is that the real audience, you can buy tickets to sit on stage and have a meal that I cook. So you're sitting in this restaurant like you're 2 feet away from Bryan Cranston having a nervous breakdown, which is probably not good for your digestion. but you're sitting on stage, and so it sort of completes this picture of where are we – is that a real world? Are those real diners? Are they – so there's a restaurant – and so it's this confusion between this sort of, you know, myth and reality, screen and the real world, and it's mixed and it's meant to sort of blur those lines.
Got it. And you're doing the food for that restaurant.
So I do the food.
Is there savory as well?
Yeah, it's savory. Uh-huh.
It's all savory.
Yeah.
I assume people are not ordering off a menu.
No, it's a set menu. They can order. They can pre-order a vegetarian version.
They can. Not.
Yeah.
That's accommodating.
But they pay for it when they buy their tickets, so they can tell us we want vegetarian, but. And it's a very small – we're actually on stage, so they've created a kitchen for me, and we work out at that. It's more like tapas style, I would say. What's interesting, though, because this is happening during the play, is that the timing is very, very, very precise. So I know you've been involved in that kind of show and film and television, so it's at like 12 minutes, 4 seconds that the main course goes out into the show. You know, we have to keep, we have like a time clock running. So that was an interesting thing to get used to. But
so how did that affect what you're, are you serving things that are at room temperature or are
yeah,
you?
Yeah, room temperature.
Okay.
Yes, they're tapas. I mean, some of them we can keep in a thermos and keep a little bit warm.
Right, but you're not trying to...
We're not cooking.
You're not trying to go for the 10.0 degree of difficulty to make your life crazy.
Right, although they did in London. They had an actual kitchen.
They did.
In backstage. And they
so it was
cooking.
An actual service, and they were putting out food to the minute.
Food went out to the, to the table to the minute. Yeah.
Okay, that's a masochistic chef.
I think people... You know, there's not that much difference between, like, we were saying, you know, this... These restaurants are partly shows in themselves, and
100%.
And so, you know, your timing is very important. And so, it wasn't that much of a stretch to coordinate. Instead of coordinated with the diners finishing their course, we coordinated with the action on the stage.
It's funny, you know. It is this interesting coming together of the what I think of as the two show must go on businesses, right?
Yeah.
Restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
I just the day before you and I are sitting here, I dropped the episode with Bo Beck from Denmark, and he was saying, you know, could you imagine if I called you and said, one of my cooks is sick, can you come tomorrow? I could, you just don't do that in the restaurant business. And he said, the show goes on. Yeah. You know, he used the theater term.
Right. Mm-hmm.
which is fascinating. So, mm-hmm. Bill, well, you earlier in this interview alluded to, I think you said, I would never say this, you said I'm old or something like that. But you're not in your 20s.
I don't feel old.
You're not in your 30s. Either of these things would be a lot for anybody. But you're doing both of these things. Are you a fitness buff? Do you have a regiment? Do you stretch a lot?
Never heard of it.
Really?
No.
You're also a very trim fellow, if you don't mind my saying.
Well, this is the only thing I've ever done, so it's stamina. I'm just running on inertia, basically.
Really? Do you think it's genetics? Are you just sort of naturally energetic and?
Perhaps, but it's nature nurture because. The restaurant business is always demanding. You have to be present. You know, I always say the thing about food is it's perishable. You cannot just turn your back because the life of the ingredient is still going on.
Yes.
So that's what I think keeps chefs very engaged and very active because you're constantly looking behind yourself at the oranges, the apples, the, you know, lettuce. And it keeps going whether that clock keeps ticking. So it's what has, I think, keeps chefs active and young at heart because they have to be constantly on all cylinders.
I will say, though, I find it to be something more true of your generation than the current generation coming up. So many people who came up when you did are still working in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of people in their 30s who have already... You know, they've got chefs de cuisine at all their places, and they're sort of off at the doing the promotional conference circuit.
No.
And they're, but you know, but then when I was researching this book I had out earlier this year,
yes, right.
You know, I would go to see Cindy Paulson in Napa, or I would go to see Nancy Silverton in Los Angeles, or I would go to see Jonathan Waxman at Barbudo in New York. They were all working.
They're still in whites, yes.
They were in. Uh-huh. They were all Nancy. Yeah. Nancy was checking on a sausage. You know, right before we sat down, we met at Cheesepaca. In her restaurant, Cindy. It was a Friday at like 5 p.m. She was getting a lamb shank ready to go in the oven. She was testing a lamb shank recipe on a Friday night, and it does seem to me. I don't know. I think it's indicative of why you guys all got into the business. You know that it wasn't for
that could be true.
Like you probably didn't see it. You probably couldn't have even fathomed that at some point in your life you'd have the opportunity to be cooking on for a Broadway show.
Yeah, I didn't. But as much as it's about that kind of entertainment, I'm not the creative side of the artistic side of theater. I mean, I'm still a chef.
Oh, sure.
And the same thing I think is probably true of those people that you mentioned. That's how we think of ourselves just in terms of the food. And maybe that what you said is very perceptive. I hadn't thought of it before, but I think maybe younger people who have seen more of the Food Network, see being a chef as much more involved with the face and talking to people and teaching people and being on camera. So they're maybe more willing and to branch out and you know, work those
up. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride, landing on a four-feet.
My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album Double Barrel Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Next year, Heritage Radio Network is turning 10. For the last decade, we've been committed to bringing listeners around the world the very best in food radio for free. Our small staff and incredible network of hosts work hard so that listeners can tune in each week to hear the important conversations in food policy, stay on the cutting edge of cocktail culture, and hear the latest updates in food tech. But there is no HRN without the support of listeners like you. Become a member of Heritage Radio Network today and help HRN get a strong start to our second decade. Choose from exclusive member gifts and stay in the loop on discounts to upcoming events. There's no better time to show your support. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate and wish HRN a happy birthday.
Welcome back to the show. We'll get you back to the rest of our interview with Bill Yassas in just a moment. But first, a reminder, if you'd like to subscribe to the show, that is the best way to keep up with us. It is free, and you can do that at Stitcher or iTunes. If you don't want to do that, you can follow the show on Instagram. Our handle is at Chef Podcast. That's at Chef Podcast. If you've been following the show for the last few episodes, you know that I was getting these ready to roll before the Christmas break at the station. And as you can hear, I'm sure in my voice, I'm fighting a little something, and I need to keep these short. So with that, I'm going to return you to the rest of my interview with Chef Bill Yasis. I hope you enjoy the rest of it. The White House. You were at the White House. Now, I so associate you with the Obamas. Because, well, first of all, President Obama had that, what did he call you, the crust master?
Crust master.
The crust master for your pies. Mm-hmm. I did not realize you had actually been hired by the Bush 41 administration. 43, excuse me, mm-hmm. administration. George W. Bush's White House. How did that opportunity come into your life? And again, you know, as with the Four Seasons, I just dying to know, was it immediately appealing?
That was pretty much immediately appealing. It's funny that you mentioned 41 because he passed away yesterday.
Yes, I should have said. May he rest in peace.
Yeah, absolute American hero.
Yeah.
Met him only a few times there, but just a kind gentleman.
Can I just say on that point?
Yeah, sure.
Because mm-hmm. it is interesting to me. I never had anything against him. I never did. I wasn't a Republican.
Right.
I thought he was he seemed like a decent person to me. He seemed like someone who was trying to do the best he could as he understood it and as he saw it. Everyone has seen these gestures, like the letter he left for Bill Clinton, you know, in the Oval Office. But I will say it's very sad to me that in the last 36 hours, I've expressed a little sadness.
So I had a much more public role with the Obama administration because of Let's Move and mm-hmm. Mrs. Obama's program. But yes, I was hired by Mrs. Bush, and that was. And you ask, like, was that something that was immediately appealing? And it was. I was kind of aware of that job because Roland Mesnier had been in it for so long, and he was well known in the pastry world, mm-hmm. and so he had retired, and then they called me and said, you know, well, it was coming up the Christmas season, and this is kind of funny a thing about the White House that I did not know, and I think most people don't know. But just like any hotel in America, the Christmas season, they do like 25% of their business, in quotation marks, in December.
You're talking about the social secretaries.
Yeah,
the social secretaries.
Yeah. And so what's happened is, and it doesn't depend on who the president is that the tradition in the House is that during that period, the administration thanks all the people that have worked with them, and that can be Secret Service, that can be the cabinet secretaries, all the different departments, you know, transportation, homeland security, legislative affairs, everything. They have their own party at the White House, and a lot of food is provided. So that was coming up, and then so they, you know, the pastry chef wanted to retire, and they were kind of like, oh, we need somebody quick.
Mm-hmm. And what prepared you for that job in your past? What do you think most made you?
Oh, that's easy. Tavern on the Green.
Yeah.
So, you know, I had always worked in New York in either big restaurants or restaurants with big reputations. So, and I think that's kind of a necessary thing that beyond the actual training of knowing all the different parts of what a baker does, whether it's viennoiserie or chocolate or petit fours or plated desserts or cakes or all these different segments that a trained pastry chef should be adept at. You also have to be able to kind of co-mingle all that and be able to function in a high-pressure environment. And that's kind of the ultimate high pressure. But mm-hmm. I felt like it's an honor, and when I grew up, you know, there was sort of like this sense of like if you're asked to do something, for your country, you do it. And that's the only thing I really know how to do is make cupcakes. So I thought I was, you know, I could make this.
You were called to service. Yeah.
And I was proud to do it. Yeah. Still am.
What was the experience like? I mean, you mentioned the Christmas, but just being there. How is that? Does that take a long time to get used to?
I never got used to it. I never was jaded. I walked through those gates was a very thrilling goosebump moment every mm-hmm. time. First of all, the thing that shocked me the most is how beautiful the White House is. So it was designed by an Irish architect, James Hoban. The site was, of course, chosen by George Washington, and construction started in 1791, ended in 1799. He died in 1799, so he never lived there. John Adams was the first president to move into the White House. But it's just a... it was meant to be a showpiece, even though there was this sort of conflict, the Jeffersonian and Adams-Washington sort of conflict of, are we a monarchy? Does this president need to be, so exalted? And Washington and Adams thought he did. Jefferson thought he didn't. Mm-hmm. But even Jefferson, you know, knew that it had to be a symbol of this new country. And anyway, James Hoban, the Irish architect, made a beautiful house. It's just stunning when you think of it's built on a hill. So when you look at it from Pennsylvania Avenue, it looks like there's only two floors. Mm-hmm. So it's a very simple design. But since it's built on a hill, there's actually six. And it's just the way he designed it, this Palladian simplicity, this kind of architectural, basically rectangle that you see, hides a very complex system inside of rooms that are just made for entertainment. Mm-hmm. The ground, the what we call the state floor, is just for entertainment. To this day, there's no bathroom on that floor, which is stunning.
That's crazy.
There's no bathroom on the state floor. So you're just meant to come in, drink your tea or your eggnog or enjoy the sight and get out, mm-hmm. Not having enough time to go to the bathroom.
Right. What else that you're able to talk about without violating, protocol?
Disclosures.
But what else was surprising to you there?
Well, the beauty of the place, certainly. And I'll go into a heavier subject.
Sure.
Washington, D.C. was chosen as the capital of our country, originally it was New York, to satisfy the southern states. So remember that during the Revolutionary War, war was declared on England to war of independence, and the southerners were like, well, wait a second, that's our best trading partner. Now you want to go to war with the people that we sell everything to, and you're ruining our economy. If you want us to go along with this, at least put the capital in a southern state. So Washington, D.C. was created, and that was a nod to the southern states. So it is still a sort of a southern city.
Yeah.
If you go out, and all you have to do is order iced tea in Washington, D.C. to know you're in the South.
Yeah.
Because there's like 4 tablespoons of sugar in your iced tea to this day. So, and then when you look at, okay, even though it was an Irish architect, the White House has a very southern sort of Bell Plantation look to it with the columns. And then one of the very surprising things is that much of the staff, butlers, are Afro-American.
Mm-hmm.
This can be another part of our talk, but there's a very interesting thing there is that the resident staff, who are not appointed by any president, they are officially, but they stay from administration to administration. So there was a man there, extraordinary man, William Hamilton, and he was hired during the Eisenhower administration as a young man, Afro-American gentleman. And he would say to us, when I first started here, there were bathrooms for coloreds in the White House. That was shocking to me.
Yeah.
I think it should be shocking to anyone. Mm-hmm. But when you think of it, it was very much a southern city in the 1960s. And they had separate bathrooms for black and white.
Mm.
And which really tells us a lot about where we are in this day and age. But the funny thing about Bill was that he would say, of course, I never used them. He goes, they weren't as nice as the other ones. And Bill was a very irascible character and a very independent man. And he was one of the only Afro-Americans who attended Martin Luther King's speech on the Lincoln Memorial, because others who worked there were afraid they would be fired if they went to
They were spotted there.
Spotted there.
Yeah. Also, am I correct about this? Aren't a number of the people, the butlers and whatnot, and people who work at the White House, aren't there a lot of multi-generational people
families?
On families?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Nepotism is alive and well at the White House.
You refer to that as nepotism.
It used to be. And, okay, so I'm...
Well, I had mentioned to you before we were recording, but I knew the late Walter Scheib, who had been the White House chef, so I heard some of this stuff from him. Right. And I do remember him. He loved the butlers at the White House.
They're amazing.
He loved them.
They're devoted public servants, and they never get any credit, so...
Yeah.
Give a prayer for the resident staff, because they're very hardworking and they don't ask for recognition. They don't want it, really.
And he also, on a much different level, loved the Secret Service.
Oh, they're amazing.
Who he said were, very, you know, in a very subtle way, were omnipresent.
They're very hardworking people. I mean, all these people, they don't go to their anniversary party, their kids' graduation, their kids' birthdays, their everything, their funerals, because if they have to be present, they are.
Yeah. Okay.
What were we talking about?
The White House, the volume, to have Tavern volume, on the Green prepared.
So, and this incredible, you said what was surprising about it was that this image, so when you think of foreign leaders coming to the White House, they're coming to this very, like, southern mansion, and most of the staff Afro-American. And but it's interesting because these are some of the most competent and kind and... just the very definition of hospitality is what is, you know, the aim of the team at the White House, and they achieve it daily, as I say, in a very selfless way. So that was, a surprise. And both Mrs. Bush and Mrs. Obama, who that's kind of really who you work for in the kitchen, said, I don't want this to seem like a hotel. When people come here, they're coming to a home. That's why... Every menu is different. Every time, it's supposed to be that these people are coming to our home for a special event for them. So they didn't want to see, like, paper doilies on things, or I remember this, cardboards under the cake. Your cake, you don't put cardboards under your cake at home. You put it on your best platter, and you serve that to your guests. And that's what they wanted, you know. So I got... You know, I mistakenly ordered some cardboard because that's just what I do.
Right.
And they were like, no, you don't get it. This is a home. This is, put your cake on the friggin' platter, Bill. I think that's really wonderful. I think that's so cool that this symbol of our democracy is a home, a temporary home, as President Obama always used to say, don't break anything, it's rented. we're not.
Right.
We're just temporary here. So that was maybe one of the interesting surprise things in terms of coming from a restaurant background.
Yeah.
Now you're working in somebody's home.
Yeah. So let's go way back. How did you first set your sights on the professional kitchen? And how did you decide to focus on the sweet stuff?
So I was a French major in college. I was surrounded.
Where was that?
Originally in Toledo, Ohio. I was a French major there. And then I went to school at Rutgers in New Jersey. And so I was kind of surrounded by French culture and French people, and that means French food. And so I was exposed to French food, and then I, after college, I moved to France for a amount of time. And I took a job in a restaurant there, and I was just totally smitten. Mainly by the markets, I think. The markets are just so mind-blowing. And I just never looked back. I want to do food. And then, so I did, you know, kind of was in the savory chef world, the culinary world for a while. But I was very attracted to the visual appeal of, you know, design desserts and the colors and the precision and the ability to create a plate that was, you know... you know, kind of fussy, as which is a negative term, but that's what appealed to me, this kind of design element of desserts.
It seems to me at the time when you, when do you go into your first professional kitchen? What year, roughly?
Well, that would be, I was at a restaurant. I asked to do a stage in New York through a friend of mine at a place called Perrigore Park.
Sure.
Perrigore Park, which is now Vaucluse.
Vaucluse, the Michael White restaurant.
Yeah.
Still French.
So, yeah, still back French again because I was American for a while.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful man who was a pastry chef. He had come from the Moulin de Mougin, Roger Verger's three-star restaurant, and he was making desserts there. He agreed to let me stage or apprentice there. And that was the first time I was in a professional kitchen.
Okay. But the pastry chefs at that time, it wasn't necessarily there weren't that many well-known pastry chefs in this country. Very few.
Yeah, and I think that's probably true.
And I think very few Americans, you know, it's always striking to me that when Chez Panisse opened in 1971, there was Lindsay Scherer, there was a dedicated pastry chef. That was not a normal thing, certainly back then.
Well, the hotels had them.
Yeah.
And you're right, they weren't celebrated, but chefs weren't celebrated either. The head chef
agreed.
You know, you were back of the house. You were kind of dirty, noisy people that you produce the food, we'd rather not know how you do it.
And,
But, I think...
Did it seem at all remarkable that you chose to do that at the time to other people?
No, I don't think so. I think already, because that was... Remember, this was the time when Michel Gérard was at Régine's in a discotheque, and there was a three-star French chef who was in a discotheque in New York City. And Michel Gérard was kind of broke that mold, and so then chefs became, you know, and Bocuse started to appear, and that whole aura of nouvelle cuisine is what really established it as a part, and was highly criticized for being too small and too precious and too expensive, but we were so proud of that. We were so proud that we had this French tradition of fine food that was rejecting. We were so rebellious, you know. We were making this very, very refined food, rejecting butter sauces, etc. And you had Jean-Jacques Rachou at La Côte Basque, and he was drawing these beautiful flowers in sauce on the plate, and it just elevated the whole restaurant experience to this real... this glorious experience. You go in and there was a painting on your plate in the sauces. It's crazy.
That all rang your bell. That all appealed
to
you.
It all rang my bells. And the pastry chefs at that time were lagging a little bit behind because they were still doing chariots or carts, pastry carts. But some were doing plated desserts, and that was, you know, that was beginning to come to the fore. And then I started working with David Boulay, who was very much into the contemporary French style and all plated desserts, no desserts other than what was very carefully crafted on the plate. Mm-hmm. And pastry chefs became a little bit more like chefs because they were cooking to order. They were balancing flavors. They weren't just following a recipe. There was a little bit more seat-of-the-pants kind of cooking going on.
And more, am I not mistaken, this to me... Now, I always say I was alive, but I wasn't around food at this time. This to me is also when, you know, because there was a time that overlaps with the time you're talking about, like the Regine's restaurant in New York. You know, I know when he was there, Larry Forgione was buying his desserts from a baker. And it was the same baker that Buzzy O'Keefe at River Cafe was buying. That's how they met.
But that was the end of that era.
That was the fade out of that. Yeah. And it seemed to me also, though, you said, you know, even if you were doing the desserts in-house, you know, there was the cart and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it seems to me like this was when you would start to see desserts that were of a piece with the savory that had gone before, that there
That's
was
right.
a sensibility both in
That's
flavor
right.
and visual sensibility that was compatible, I would call it,
That's right.
with the what the what was coming up from the savory side of the kitchen.
That's
Is that accurate?
That was one of the tenets of nouvelle cuisine.
Yeah.
Was that it was a it was a unified experience. It was seamless that you came in and you were having this rapturous moment from beginning to end, and there wasn't a break where, okay, now I'm going to like slice a cake on a
right.
on a cart, which I remember saying that in 1985 to Drew, and he said, well, don't diminish the role of the dining room, which was very interesting.
Drew Napoorant.
Which is very interesting that he said that, and I realized that he's right. I mean, we're the front of the house is the team, part of the team, and we're partners. If they are not equally elevated and respected, then the food will not be presented in the way that it should be. So that was, I mean, and that was a long time ago that he said that, and he's right.
Well, you know, that what you just said reminds me of, you know, there's certain conversations I've had over my career where I realize that this notion, you know, Will Goddara at 11 Madison Park said to me once, he doesn't use, they don't say front of the house and back of the house, right? Mm-hmm. Eric Repair, very famously, I guess now that it's in his memoir, was originally in school to be a waiter. And at the school where he went, you could do that, or you could learn how to be a cook. Mm-hmm. And they weren't, one wasn't seen as more grand than the other. They were both seen as proud professions, right?
Yes. The European system it is a profession.
Yeah. And, in New York, the cliche was, you know, your waiter's probably, you know,
an actor
going to an audition later or whatever. Right. But, and then just in the last week, I dropped an interview with Magnus Nilsson, mm-hmm. who was saying that he, has always felt very lonely in his career because he's the only person at Faviken who was there from the beginning, right? And he said, when I do my next restaurant, if I do another restaurant, I want to do it with a partner. And I said, you mean a co-chef? And he said, no. And I said, oh, you mean dining room? He said, I don't draw those distinctions. We're all just doing a restaurant. You know, it's interesting. It's very different from, I think, the way we're oriented here in the United States, generally speaking. Maybe it's changing now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I think, that's a very astute observation. I think it is changing, and for the better. Yeah. Well, there's a wonderful restaurant in the village called Jeju. I think they just got a Michelin star, where there is no distinction. The people, you work at the restaurant, and you cook, and your schedule includes sometimes in the dining room, and you serve the food. So it's one team.
Yeah.
They're sort of wearing whites in the mm-hmm. dining room, but the waiters and cooks are all the same group.
Yeah.
And you circulate throughout.
Interesting. Interesting. So what was it like collaborating with a young David Boulay?
It was very thrilling. That was a time when, you know, we were talking about this, how there was this, like, this active prise de conscience, this active like awareness that this is a huge wave of new thinking about food. And, you know, we're sort of pretentiously and arrogantly thinking how much we're changing the world. But the plates were beautiful. And that was the other thing, the plateware was, you started to see like this very elegant dinnerware in restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, people thought, well, you're going to break them anyway, so just put them on a plain plate. But now you had real china. And David is a mercurial, eccentric, very exciting chef. I still think he has probably one of the finest palates in the world. The other one would be Girardet, Freddy Girardet. I'm talking about people who are not very active right now. Pierre Hermé, another one.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Langs passed away, but the founder of La Maison de Chocolat. These are people that, I'll give you an example, like David Boulay would have a recipe for a stock, and it would be X amount of chervil that went in the stock, and he would taste the stock later, and he would say, like, oh, you forgot the chervil. I mean, that's really, he has, you know, some people have like 40-20 vision.
Yeah.
They have better than 20-20 vision. He has 40-20 palate.
I ate at his right before he closed that summer when he was getting ready to shut it down. I twice went to
Boulay. At the old restaurant at 165 Duane? Or? Mm-hmm. So I was still there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm sorry. No. The more recent.
Broadway. Oh, this one. Hudson. Yeah. On Hudson.
Wasn't it on Duane also?
Hudson and Duane, yes.
Yeah, in the corner. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, but still amazing. Still amazing.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, food that just
food was great.
Knocked you back on
and
your
original.
Heels. Yes.
I mean, he comes up with very original. I mean, it might be inspired by X, Y, or Z, but the food and the progression is very original.
Was he as a younger man as, I mean, you said mercurial and whatnot. I mean, I've interviewed him only in the last several years, right? Found him obviously brilliant, but also definitely on his own, in his own astral, on his own astral plane.
Yeah.
I mean, I did an interview. We did an interview for my book. We spent 5 hours together.
No, and
but I can't say that it was all about food or it was all about the topic of my book. But it was fascinating. I would have sat for another 5 hours. But he's always been known, sort of. You know, people talked in the old days that sometimes, you know, there'd be a lag between courses, and but that might be because he was improvising on the spot, right?
Right, yes, very much so. Very much the auteur, artiste.
Yeah, artist temperament.
Artist temperament. The meal would be fantastic, but it could last a long time. My favorite story is one that Dominique Simon, who was the longtime maitre d' there, tells about this one day when there was this huge snowstorm in New York. And so they were afraid that there would be a lot of cancellations. And so David said, take everything, take all of it. And, you know, they were saying, well, you know, if everybody does show up, there'll be waits. And he was like, no, they're all going to cancel, so take everything. And so they all showed up. It was in the snow, snowing down. There was a line out. So this is a fancy restaurant. You know, out the door, in the snow, all the way over to Hudson. And Dominique Simon was going around and, like, passing out hot chocolate or something, and then he got to the end of the line, and there's a guy in a wheelchair.
Oh my God!
In the snow, and the guy goes, "How long do I have to wait to get in there?" But that also has to do with that, you know, this sort of that aura of that period when like people would do anything to sit at certain tables in New York.
And I also think it's hard for people to fathom, you know, that people say this, you know, people frequently, it's an exaggeration, but, you know, I did a talk with Ruth Reichel a couple of months ago when my book came out. And, you know, I made the comment that I thought there was very little separation between chefs and journalists back then, right? And she said, yeah, well, there were like 10 people in America who cared about food. You know? And similarly, people have said to me about New York at that time, and even, they don't talk about the U.S. in general much differently, you know, that there were like 10 restaurants where you wanted to work. You know, that was it. Mm-hmm. Like, if you were coming
that's
up.
That's interesting. Yes, very true.
Right?
Very
if you
true.
Were if you were coming up, you wanted to work for Jeremiah at Starz. You wanted to work for Wolfgang in L.A. You wanted to work who would it be in New York? You wanted to work for Waxman. You wanted to work for Boulay. You depending on your kind of style.
Le Pose, Le Bernardin,
and on the, you know, for the old school, Rashu was known for taking on Americans before most people.
Definitely,
Jean Louis in D.C. But like there weren't a ton of places that you wanted to go
there
as a young cook.
Much good food. Yeah,
yeah. But to me, what you're talking about speaks to the customer side of that equation.
Oh, I see. Yeah, that, so you were jamming the only good places that were there. Yeah, and that audience was growing, and awareness was growing, and so that's why you get a line out the door for the places that were really top notch. And trying to. It's also about the ingredients, too, which there wasn't enough, you know, of this kind of great produce, great fish, great all the meats and everything and proteins, which more and more that chain has gotten stronger and better produce is available now.
Was there an equivalent to that in the pastry side? Were there things that you...
Well, the pastry still I think, caught up in that sense. The... It's happening, but fruits, for example. I mean, now you have some of these great fruit purveyors in California and even in Florida and around the country. And there's more foraging and this kind of, like, so you get wild berries now, like huckleberries, where you couldn't before.
Mm-hmm.
They're catching up, but definitely an ingredient-driven menu is fully... is in charge of the pastry menu as well.
Mm-hmm.
So ingredient-driven, seasonally driven. And that local, I don't really care that much about. I'll go out on a limb. Because for me, You know, how much local in January in New York do you want to feed? What I say, well, right. I do, I'm devoted to local, but what I say is if the person growing this is a responsible person in their locality, if they care about their locality, if they care about, if they have some humanity and they're treating their workers well and they're treating their community well, if they're tied into their community, that's local to me. You're, mm-hmm. you're supporting your locality. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't have to come within 50 miles of New York State, because in dessert, you won't make much.
No, not in the season that we're plunging
carrot
into.
Cake, maybe.
Carrot cake. So when you think about the future for yourself, I mean, obviously you're not that far in here. But is there unfinished business for Biliasis at this point in time? Or are you just sort of like taking it as it comes?
No, I have a 5-year plan. We are fully intend to open a small cafe bakery, which is on the boards, and because we the theater stuff has been very successful, we're being asked to do other things, and this restaurant is, you know, I mean, it's just the beginning, but you can feel that there's just great energy here, there's great people, we have a wonderful team, and so we're hoping for growth in this restaurant as well, and so we're working on building an outside commissary, because as big as this restaurant is, it is in a skyscraper in New York City, and there's only so much
right
real estate space that you can use. So
yeah.
We need more space to produce more uh-huh. and better stuff. Chocolates in particular, we want to. We want to start a wide chocolate program and
oh, great.
Have wonderful chocolates.
Great. Mm-hmm. So I always say this is a chef show, not a food show, but I am curious going in. You know, we're awash in the holiday season now. What is your favorite holiday treat?
Oh, the aforementioned. Right now, it depends what day you ask me, but I'm really into the marron glacé, these mm-hmm. Chestnuts.
You personally as an eater?
As an eater,
yeah.
Yes. I eat way too many of them. So it's sort of a seasonal treat in Europe, and
yeah.
it sometimes is translated here. But we get these great chestnuts from a company called Sabaton in France, and it's one of those kind of food companies that I really admire in that it's a family still owned, like the coffee syrup Trablet. It's still the same family from fourth, fifth generation. And you go to the factory in chestnut season, and you see these, you know, I until like 5 years ago, I didn't even know what a chestnut looked like. It's a beautiful, green, spiky thing. But the problem with chestnuts is when you open them, the skin, just like with walnuts, is deeply embedded in the nut itself. So when you go to the Sabaton factory, you see all these ladies, and it's all women, and they're wearing like the white smock and white face mask and a hat, and they're with this needle, I think they probably bring it from home, with a needle they're pulling these little shreds of nut skin out of the flesh of the chestnut. And to this day I've been using Sabaton chestnuts for, and I'm not plugging them, but I am plugging
that's
them.
Okay.
They, to this day, I have never found a single scrap of chestnut skin in a Sabaton chestnut, and they're
it's a
huge.
Bold statement.
They're as bold,
yeah.
And they're huge. They're like
yeah,
bigger than any chestnuts you find elsewhere. So yeah, I'm really into that right now.
So that's your thing.
So we glaze them very lightly. You know, fondant is not particularly you know, in vogue now.
Mm-hmm.
Fondant is what you put on top of poured fondant. Put on top of eclairs, but we thin it out, and so it just gets a very light glaze, and we mix in some single malt, and so that gives a little extra
sounds
punch
great.
To our marron glacé.
Okay, you're grinning widely as you talk
oh,
about
yeah,
it.
They're magical.
It's so
yeah.
great. It's so great. I mean, so many chefs I know are still so in love with the food.
Totally.
It's amazing.
I mean, why else do it?
Yeah.
It has to be delicious.
All right. Well, thank you for sitting down with me.
Oh, thank
I'm glad
you.
We persisted.
Fun. I knew it would be. I knew because when we talked for the book, we had such a good time. So
thank
I
you.
Knew it would be. I'm sorry that we had to reschedule.
Oh, no.
Times.
It's fine. I'll tell you off air, but I try to be the easiest person to cancel on in the restaurant business.
You are. Yeah. Most people won't talk to you again.
Stuff comes up. Yeah. All right. All the best for the holidays and for the new year.
Thank you.
Thanks. And that's our show for today, and that is also a wrap for the season. Thank you all for listening. Chef Bill Yasis, thank you for being our guest today. And Kat and Vitor at Heritage, thank you for all the extra work you did to get these shows up during the holiday season. I hope you guys are enjoying your time off. And to all of you out there in podcast land, happiest of New Year's, and we will see you back early in 2019 on Andrew Talks to Chefs.